Okay, why don't you take out your Bibles, please, and turn them to the book of Genesis chapter 17. We were in chapter 22. We're going to kind of be all over from Genesis 12 all the way to 22. Oh, man, I'm full right now. We had such a great prayer meeting, all-church prayer meeting before the service. My heart was full after that. And then after singing those songs, hearing that testimony, and then watching that video, I'm like, maybe we should just wrap it up now. I'm good to go, but all right, well, we'll just keep the blessings going, Lord willing, and we'll see what God can do now through his word. But today we're coming to the end of our series on idolatry, and I trust that you've seen now, as we've gone through this series, that idolatry is far more than just, you know, what ancient uncivilized tribes do when they bow before some wooden statue that they've created. That's maybe how we first thought of it. I trust that that whole idea has now just been blown up, and we see as we read the scriptures that idolatry is far, far deeper than that. One of the great examples of this in the New Testament comes at the end of what we call the letter of 1 John. If you've ever read 1 John, it's five chapters long. It's 105 verses, and throughout it, John talks about how we live as Christians in relationship with Jesus, in fellowship with him, what that looks like. But have you ever noticed how it ends? For 105 verses, John does this, and then the very last way he wants to summarize his entire letter and wrap everything up, he finishes with these words, "Dear children, keep yourselves from idols." What? He has not talked about idols at all. He has not talked about going to temples and bowing before idols. And yet he summarizes and wraps up his entire letter with, "Dear children, keep yourselves from idols." Why would he bring up idols and fellowship with Jesus? Author David Paulison gives this answer. He says, John's last line properly leaves us with that most basic question which God continually poses to each human heart. Has something or someone besides Jesus Christ taken title to your heart's trust, preoccupation, loyalty, service, fear, and delight? That's the question of idolatry. What has our hearts? That's the very first commandment, right? You shall have no other gods before me. Anything else that comes above our Maker, our Savior Jesus Christ, then is by definition an idol. So as we come to the end of this series, I want to tackle one more idol, and as you've heard, it's the idol of control. And I want to show how the scriptures are going to show us what that is, and then Lord willing, this morning we're going to experience a great liberation from it. Okay, so let's begin then simply by identifying the idol of control. What are we talking about here? We're picking up the story here in the book of Genesis. If you read Genesis, you know that Adam and Eve plunged the world into evil and into chaos, and yet God, out of his sheer mercy and love, promises to bring a rescue to the world. In chapter 12, he appears to this man named Abram, and he promises him that through his line, he will bless all the peoples of the world. Now, if God makes a promise to you that through your line, blessing is going to come to the whole world, what has to be true of you? Well, it's very obvious. You obviously need to get married and you need to have a kid. That promise cannot come true if you have no kids. Now, Abraham's got the first one down. He's married to a woman who at this point, her name is Sarai, but there's a problem. His wife, Sarai, cannot have children. She's also very old. Not only that, Abraham is old. In Hebrews 11, it says he was past age and as good as dead. Well, flattering, isn't it? To complicate matters, a full decade has passed since Genesis chapter 12. A whole decade goes by. God makes the promise. A decade goes by and nothing happens. And so what happens in the story then is that Abram and his wife Sarai, what they try to do is to take control of the situation. They say, oh man, God's really not coming through. We need to do something about this. And so they try to seize their own destiny. They try to control their lives. And so what Abram does is he adopts a man named Eleazar, who is one of his household servants. He adopts him into his family, and he says, okay, since really God's not figuring this out, maybe this is the way we'll do it. I'll make Eleazar my heir, and my line can continue through Eleazar. But that is not what God promised. And so God appears to him again in chapter 15, and he says, quote, "This man shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir." But again, there's no child. This is rather problematic. And so Abram and Sarai again become impatient. They think, what is God doing? He's made this promise, but he's not coming through on it. And so again, they grasp for control of their lives. They try to control the situation and make this promise come to pass. And so Sarai, his wife, proposes to Abram. This is a weird one. Get ready for it. Not many wives today are going to propose this. She proposes that Abram take a woman named Hagar, who is Sarai's kind of servant. Take my servant, marry her, Abram, take another wife, and then have kids through her, and then that will progress the family line. Any of you guys, your wives come to you talk like that? That's not so common. That's what they decide to do, and so that's exactly what happens. And then Abram has a son through her, and his name is Ishmael. Now, all this took place 11 years after God made his original promise. But again, that is not what God promised. How much clearer can God make it than to say, this heir will come from your own body. It will be your own son. It's not somebody else. And yet Abram and Sarai feel like they need to control their lives and their destiny. And so now we get to chapter 17. This is now 24 years after the original promise. Look at chapter 17. This is, sorry, this is not in your insert, but if you have a Bible, I will put it on the screen for you as well. Chapter 17, verses 15 to 18. "And God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah," referring to many, she's a princess of many, "shall be her name. I will bless her, and moreover, I will give you a son by her," not by Hagar. "I will bless her, and you shall become nations. Kings of people shall come from her." Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said to himself, "Shall a child be born to a man who's 100 years old? Shall Sarah, who's 90 years old, bear a child?" And Abraham said to God, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before you." So you see what's happening here? Instead of trusting God, Abram is trying to seize control of his own life and his own destiny. Even when God makes these promises, he still cannot relinquish control. He says, just give it to Ishmael. This whole thing is too impossible. We, in many ways, are just like Abram. Old Testament scholar Tremper Longman III, whom I'm borrowing some things from this morning, says this. He says, "We all tend to operate out of a faulty assumption that looks something like this. If only I could control my world, life would be manageable and have meaning and purpose. Related to this faulty assumption is an equally faulty one. I ought to be able to control my world." So, this is a very subtle idol. I didn't begin with this one because it's a little more subtle than some of the other ones that we've looked at that are a little more obvious. The line between good control, control is a good thing, and idolatrous control is not always so clear. It's not always so easy to discern. Of course, you remember throughout this series, we've been saying that an idol is a good thing that we've made into a God thing. So we always want to say, what's the good thing? We got to celebrate the good thing. That's okay. Here's what I'm going to say. Control and power are inherently good things. Ponder on that for a second. They are inherently good things. For instance, God created us to work, to fill the earth, to develop culture, to develop cities. We are to bring order out of disorder. We are to cause things to come to pass. We are to try to work. Work is an effort to control things, isn't it? Nothing wrong with trying to control the world under God. For instance, think of the book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs tells us we ought to consider the future. We ought to plan for the future. We ought to make plans where we try to control things to a certain level so that the future will be secured. We're to think about consequences that will arise from our choices, and we are to act rightly. We are to act in ways that ensure our lives are rightly ordered. So the Bible never calls us to be passive. Never. Think of Proverbs 6:6. it blasts the person who out of laziness says, oh, you know, I'll just sit around and I'll relax and maybe even just say, well, God will take care of me. It sounds very spiritual, but it's not spiritual at all. And Proverbs says, go to the ant. Look to the ant, you sluggard. I love the Proverbs. Consider its ways and be wise. It stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. In other words, we are called to use power to control our lives. So, you know, the laundry gets done, you know, the dishes get washed, your mortgage gets paid, the food gets prepared, the term paper gets written, the rent gets paid, the work at your job gets done. All these type of things, you are called to use the power God has given you to control those kind of areas. So I'll put it this way. The human desire for control and power, when it is under God, is inherently a good thing. But there's the line, right? Because what so often happens is our need for control gets out of control. We have a word for this in our culture when people start to do that, don't we? Well, two words. We call them control freaks. We call them control freaks. And or not just, it's not like a certain type of person. It's all of us. At a certain moment, it's like, hey, you're being a control freak. Stop it. That's when that line has been crossed. So how can you tell when this good desire for control and power used in a good way has crossed the line and become idolatrous control? Here's some thoughts to get you going. You can see that control has become an idol when you find yourself in conflict with others because of your need to control, or maybe because of their need to control. You remember we've said throughout this series, the gods are always violent. Look at the old Greek gods. You remember the old Greek gods, Zeus and Poseidon and Hades. They go to war against the elder gods. They defeat them because they want control and power over the air and over the sea and over the underworld. And so they have violence and they win that war, so they have control. And this is always what's happening in our lives. When we want to control things, when we want to be our own gods, that's exactly what happens. We go to war with other people. It's a battle for control. I mean, this is on a global level with wars, and this is on little relational levels with your best friend, with your spouse, with your sibling, with your parents, perhaps. And then what we see is that when we try to be a god, we find ourselves at war with others because we do not get what we want, and so therefore we find ourselves in conflict. That's one way that you can see, oh man, I am becoming a control freak because I'm in conflict with other people. Another way you can see it, you can see that control has become an idol when you get very upset because your carefully crafted schedule gets interrupted. This is a big one for me. Listen to this. This is a gem of a little thought. I was listening to a man some years ago at Trinity Western Chapel. His name was Keith Price. He was mentored by A.W. Tozer himself. And so I thought, I got to hang out with this guy because I was a big A.W. Tozer fan. So I had lunch with him, got to spend some time with him farther on. And his little thought in his sermon that day has stuck with me forever. He said, have you ever noticed, as you read the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that almost every single story we have of Jesus is an interruption to his schedule? I mean, Jesus had a schedule. Read Luke, for instance. It talks about how he's setting his face toward Jerusalem. He is on his way to Jerusalem. But then look at, for instance, Luke 8 is a perfect example. Jesus steps off a boat. All of a sudden, his carefully crafted schedule gets interrupted by a man named Legion, who has a legion of demons within him, and there's this massive demonic issue going on. Jesus goes aside. He deals with that. He frees this man. Just as he's freed this man, then all of a sudden, a man named Jairus comes along, and he interrupts Jesus' schedule, and he says, Jesus, I want you to come to my house because my 12-year-old daughter is dying. Jesus is like, all right, we'll go over to the house. We'll take care of this. Jesus is on his way to deal with the interruption to his interruption, and then he gets interrupted because a woman who has had some sort of 12-year menstrual bleeding problem comes up, and she's like, I need to be healed, and touches the hem of his garment and derails the whole thing. So Jesus is interrupted from the interruption by another interruption. You see what I'm saying? So if Jesus had never been interrupted, how many stories would we actually have of him? Ponder that next time you read the Gospels, and then ponder your own life. And I think to myself, how many opportunities, has God put in my path that are interruptions to my schedule that I've missed because I'm like, no, I got to keep to the schedule. Now, there's some limits to these kind of things, but read the Gospels and you'll see interruptions. How much is there this idolatrous need to control my schedule and I'm missing out on the very things God wants to do in my life? You can see control becoming an idol in your life when you're constantly frustrated about how other people do things because you feel like you need to micromanage them. If you're a micromanager, that's probably one of your idols, if you're that kind of a person, because, you know, they just don't get it. You can see control has become an idol when you feel a great need to control your image, how you come across to other people, whether that's physically or whether that's just like your reputation or things. And then if you're, for instance, willing to lie in order to twist something so your image is maintained, or you're willing to slander other people so that you look a little bit better, what is that? That's an idolatrous need to control your image. Or one final way, you can see that control has become an idol by how you spend your money. It's like the story about the man who was accusing his wife in front of a counselor, saying, you know, like pointing out to her, you certainly have a problem with control. You're always trying to control your image to everybody else, and so you spend so much money trying to make your appearance look so well. And in a sense, he was right. And then the counselor pointed out to him, but you also have an idolatrous need to control through your money because you won't spend a penny on anyone else. You hardly give away any money. You sock away every cent because you feel the need to control your entire life through feeling secure. So whether it's excessive spending or excessive saving, both could be needs for control, right? So maybe those will kind of get you going, kind of get prime the pump and start thinking, okay, where are those areas in my life where I'm trying to control things all the time, like Abram, and I'm doing it in ways it's wrecking everything. That's identifying the idol. Now that we've identified it, let's move to our second heading, which is to expose the idol of control. Part of the way, remember, that we said we break the power of the idols is we expose them. We show how they always fail us. They make these great promises, but they always fail us. So let's look at that. Let's look at the results of Abram's idolatrous control. Turn back with me to Genesis chapter 16. Genesis 16 and verses 4 to 6, I'll put it on the screen in case you don't have a Bible. 16, 4 to 6. And Abram went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress. That's on Sarai. And Sarai said to Abram, may the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked on me with contempt. May the Lord judge between you and me. We got some marital issues going on. But Abram said to Sarai, behold, your servant is in your power. Do with her as you please. Then Sarai dealt harshly with her, and she fled from her. Wow. The idol of control, I think, just in this story is exposed at least in two ways. We could expose this in many ways. But let's show how this God always fails. Just from that little part of the story, what do you see? First of all, I see that rather than making our lives better, idolatrous control makes us into people who are difficult to live with. Isn't that what happened right through there? Marital problems, problems between Sarai and Hagar, problems between Abraham and his wife, and then all of a sudden now Hagar's having to flee. She's having so many problems within the family. Sarah and Hagar and Abram were all at each other's throats. Now, when you realize that Hagar's son Ishmael became the father of what are the modern Arab nations, and then you realize that Isaac is the father of the modern Jewish nation, and all the conflict that happened down there, wow, this is an exponential explosion, isn't it? Right from the beginning here, right down through history to our present day, nothing but conflict and the desire to control. Control makes you controlling, which leads to conflict. And here we see particularly in families. In C.S. Lewis's famous little book, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, there's a boy named Eustace. And Eustace is a bully. Eustace is a boy who always wants to control everything. He uses his power in many ways. He uses it to put down other children. He puts them in their place. He teases them. He tortures animals. And he also always is getting under the nerves of the adults, driving them crazy. He wants to control and use his power for his own needs. Well, one night, he finds himself in a giant cave, and he finds a treasure trove. It's a dragon's treasure, but there's no dragon there. He's so excited about this because he can imagine all the power and the control he can have with this much wealth. He can do now whatever he wants. He falls asleep on the pile of treasure. And then Lewis writes these words, sleeping on the dragon's hoard with greedy, dragonish thoughts in his heart, he had become a dragon himself. So he's transformed into an actual dragon. And what Lewis is kind of picturing there is this. You become like what you worship. You become like what you worship. When we set our hearts on control, to the need to control everything, we become controlling, and then that leads us into conflict with others. So do you see this in your life? Do you see it in your family? Do you see it in your office? Do you see it with friends of yours? When we control, the need to control, it leads us into conflict with others. That's why this idol ought to be exposed. It does not deliver. It always fails us. It doesn't say, oh, your life will be so ordered and it'll all work out. No, it's the very opposite. Everything falls out of control and we become in conflict with everybody else. There's a second way I think we should expose it. Put it this way. While we can achieve a certain level of control in our lives, complete control is a futile endeavor. It's a futile endeavor. Abram simply could not control when his wife would get pregnant. You can't control that. Yet he tried to control it. In fact, his efforts to try to control it caused his life to spin out of control. So again, listen to Tremper Longman. Such events remind us that we can't really control our lives. But that doesn't keep us from exerting enormous energy to maintain the illusion of having life in order. While we can achieve a significant level of control, keeping all the plates spinning is no more possible than grasping the wind. This touches the raw nerve of reality. The world is rigged for frustration. There is a right way of doing things, but we will never know for sure what it is. There is a way to make life work, but we will never do it right. No matter how we try, we will never be in control of our world. And Romans 8 tells us why. Romans 8 tells us these words, for the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it. In other words, what Paul is writing there is that God set up his entire original creation. The very fabric of it was meant to work in favor of human endeavors. But when Adam and Eve said, actually, you know what, God, we want to be our own God. So, you know, thank you for all that you've done for us, but we really don't want you ruling over us. We're going to become our own gods. When that happened, God tore the fabric of his own creation. When he tore the fabric of his own creation, when he subjected it to frustration, as Paul writes, what happened is things don't work the way that they're supposed to. Things just don't work the way that they're supposed to. Life does not do this, and all of this is meant to teach us that we are not gods. Despite our great desire to control, to be gods, we can't hardly control anything. Oh, this was brought home to me. This was brought home to me in many ways if you start thinking about it, but just one example I thought about. So a few years ago, I went to visit my brother-in-law in Calgary. I was just going to do a quick kind of two-day trip. We're going to do some skiing at Lake Louise. And so as I was sitting on the plane, got into my seat, I was sitting down. I thought, oh, this is so great. A one-hour flight. I mean, that is such a nice short flight compared to other flights I've done to China and Africa and all that kind of stuff. 1 hour, I'm going to be there. It'll give me enough time. I can go in, visit with his family for a while and him, get to bed at a decent hour in order for a nice, you know, big ski day the next day. So we're sitting I'm just sitting there at the terminal, or not in the terminal, in the plane at the terminal, and 15 minutes passes, half an hour passes, 45 minutes pass. It's coming up to an hour, and I'm just like, we're supposed to be touching down in Calgary right now, and here we are, we're not even moved from the actual terminal itself. And so then all of a sudden, you know, the pilot comes on over the intercom, and he says, All right, folks, Calgary Airport's a little bit fogged in this evening. We're going to taxi out. We're going to just wait at the end of the runway for a little bit. We're going to kind of see how things go. So we taxi out, go to the end of the runway. We're sitting at the end of the runway now, just sitting. 15 minutes pass, 30 minutes pass, 45 minutes pass. I'm thinking I should not even just touch down. I should be at my brother-in-law's house right now. And we've got from the gate to the end of the runway. That's all we've achieved. You know, and the captain comes on again. He says, folks, Calgary Airport is now down to one runway due to fog, and all the flights are now being rerouted to Kelowna. And so what we're going to do is we're just going to go back to the gate. We're going to deboard the plane. You can just wait there for a little bit, and then once we get the A-OK, we'll get back on the plane, and we'll get you to your destination in Calgary. So, you know, we just made it to the end of the runway. Now we're going back to the gate. We deboard the plane. We're all sitting in the little area again. But this is like, we started at like 5 o'clock, now it's like 9 o'clock at night, and I'm thinking, okay, well, we can still do this. I mean, it's going to be a very late night now, and we have an early morning tomorrow, so hopefully this goes quick. 15 minutes pass, 30 minutes pass, 45 minutes pass. I mean, it's coming up to midnight now, and they come on the intercom, and they say, Calgary Airport has now been shut down. All flights have been canceled. Please see the service desk for rescheduling. And, you know, 300 people. Now there's lineups that are like an hour and a half long after you've been sitting there waiting forever. But that's the kind of thing, isn't it? I mean, we could just go all morning telling stories like that. And so, you know, this week the schedule just got a little messed up, and I had to go right through the heart of rush hour. I live out in Langford, so I'd go through all that ridiculous rush hour, and I was pondering on this sermon. And I was like, man, this rush hour is lame. And I was just realizing, here we go again. Another great example, Barton, that you are not a God. You may think you got some skills, but you can't even make your car go another 10 feet forward because there's a car in front of you. Yeah, and then last night, 2 days ago, then I'm getting a little bit sick. So last night I had like 4 hours of sleep. So I'm like, oh man. So just another example. Now you're getting sick. How powerful are you, Barton, really? I mean, you really control your world, don't you? A little cold and you're all sniff, sniff. Ooh, now you're under the weather. You know, and the stories just go on and on and on. Your kid throws a tantrum in the middle of the store and you're just like, wow, this is what I got to deal with right now. I mean, you can't even control your two-year-old. And, you know, you think you're so great, right? You can't control any of this kind of stuff. You get sick and you miss work. All these everyday events. It's all this. The fabric of the universe has been torn. And all of this is meant to drive home one big fact to us, that we are not gods, that we cannot control our world. And generally speaking, we got to learn this the hard way. Despite our best efforts, we learn this the hard way. So this idol should just be totally exposed for what it is. It sends us into conflict with others when we try to control everything, and we can't even do it anyways. It's a futile endeavor. So we've identified the idol. We've showed how it always fails. Now for the good part. In the third place, let's defeat the idol of control. We've seen Abram struggle to trust God with his life. We've seen him try to seize control of his life and his failure to do it. But something must have happened to Abram over the years. We don't know exactly what it is. I personally think that it has a lot to do with the miraculous birth of his son Isaac. But what we discover in his story is that somewhere along the line, by Genesis chapter 22, Abram is no longer a control freak. Abram has learned how to trust God, and we see that his trust goes deep. This is the famous story in Genesis chapter 22, of course, where God commanded Abram to sacrifice his son Isaac, his only son. Now, for a man, you remember, we've seen in this story, who so desperately tries to control his life and his destiny, this command demanded that he relinquish all control. There's no control at this point. Now, sometimes, this is one of the number one case scenarios, if you read any of the modern atheists, this is one of the number one case scenarios they give to say, look at this God, what an unjust God, that he would command a man to sacrifice his son. That shows that the God you Christians worship is a completely unjust God. Sometimes I just wish people would read the Bible, because it's pretty easy. Look at verse 1 in Genesis chapter 22. Verse 1 tells us that this was a test. After these things, God tested Abram. In other words, God had no intention for the boy to die. That's not the point of the story. The point of the story is to test Abram's heart, and this is the means to do it, but God never intended it. God is not one who goes around commanding men to murder their boys. Enough said about that. What I want you to see, though, is that Abraham, the man who was ruled by idolatrous control, has been changed. Look at verses 2 and 3. He said, "Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you." Now look at the response. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. Do you see it? I mean, what a change has come over this man. He doesn't even ask any questions. He's not grasping at control anymore. He obeys immediately. Not only that, he gets up early to make sure that he's obedient. He cuts all the wood. He does all that's necessary. Abraham, somewhere along the line, clearly has surrendered control of his life to God. We read that he is fully prepared to do what God has commanded. Look at verse 6. "And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife, and so they went both of them together." Now skip down to verse 9. "Now when they came to the place of which God had told them, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven, saying, 'Abraham, Abraham!' And he said to him, 'Here I am.' He said, 'Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me.' And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son." What is absolutely clear here is that somewhere along the line, Abraham stopped trying to control his life and he surrendered it to God. To quote Longman one more time, "It's the paradox of the gospel. Strength is found in weakness. Control is found in dependency. Power is found in surrender." So if you want to defeat the idol of control in your life, here's the first thing I'll say. We defeat the idol of control when we allow the difficulties of life to humble us into a life of continual surrender to God. Rather than becoming embittered against the difficulties or just like despair, I can't do anything, we allow them to humble us to say, "God, I clearly this teaches me I am not God. I want to submit to your hand, to your leading, and to trust you with what you want to do with my life." That's a painful process, though, isn't it? But this is the way to become truly human. You are made by God and for God. This is what happened to Eustace. He was humbled when he became a dragon and he didn't want to be one. He wanted to be a boy again. And so one night, the great lion Aslan came to him. And Aslan challenged him to undress, that is to take off his dragon scales, get rid of his dragonish nature. And so he tried. He peeled off a few of the scales, but underneath was just another layer. And so he tried again and again, but he could not do it. And finally, the lion said this, "You will have to let me undress you." Then Eustace says, "I was afraid of his claws, I can tell you. But I was pretty nearly desperate now, so I just lay flat on my back to let him do it. The very first tear he made was so deep that I thought it had gone right into my heart. And when he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I've ever felt. Well, he peeled that beastly stuff right off, just as I thought he'd done it, just as I thought I'd done it myself the other three times, only they hadn't hurt. And there it was, lying on the grass, those scales only ever so much thicker and darker and more knobbly looking than the others had been. And there I was, as smooth and as soft as a peeled branch and smaller than I had been. I'd turned into a boy again." And of course, Aslan represents Christ. It's a vivid picture of how when we humble ourselves before God, we stop trying to control everything, but we have to expose ourselves to him. We have to say, do with me what you will. And oftentimes it will hurt at the beginning. The claw can go deep, but it's all designed for our good. If we allow the difficult experiences in life to not embitter us, to not lead us to despair, but rather to humble us before God, we begin to discover that he is working these things out for our good. He's liberating us from the dehumanizing effects of our control freak natures. But you'll never surrender yourself fully to God, especially if you're going through really hard times, unless you believe deep in your heart that he really has your best interests in mind, that he really loves you. And this is the crux of the matter. This is the deepest part of our human souls. Deep within us, like Adam and Eve, we do not trust him. We are suspicious of him, suspicious of his love, suspicious of what he might do to us. So let me put it this way. The only way we will surrender fully, that is when through the gospel, we see that God can be trusted with control of our lives. It's the gospel, the good news of the Bible that gets down that deep part of us that allows us, like Eustace, to lay down on our backs, to open up our arms and say, do with me what you will. Only the gospel can do this, friends. So let's hear the gospel afresh. For in the gospel, we find one who, like Isaac, was a one and only son. In the gospel story, we discover one like Isaac who took a three-day journey like Isaac did, a journey that led towards death, but then in a great reversal, death turned into life. In the gospel story, we learn about one like Isaac who climbed a hill because his father told him to. In the gospel, we discover one like Isaac who struggled up that hill because of the wood that he had to carry. In the gospel story, we discover one like Isaac, a son who trusted his father, a son who surrendered all control of his life to his father, and this son said, not my will, but yours be done. And in this good news, in this story, Jesus, that son, laid himself down on the wood. He voluntarily did what his father asked of him. Like Isaac, he did not struggle. He did not run away. However, when God raised the knife of justice above his son, there was no voice from heaven. There was no voice that cried out and said, do not lay a hand on the boy. There was no such voice when the nails pierced Jesus' wrists and when they pierced his feet. There was no voice calling out. There was no substitute provided for Jesus. Jesus, the Son, laid himself on that giant piece of wood, and he was slaughtered. But here's what we discover in that story. What you may not know is that the hill that Abram and Isaac climbed, that hill, Mount Moriah, is the hill where the temple was built and where the crucifixion grounds were a couple thousand years later. In other words, the place where Jesus was crucified was the same place where the substitute ram was given. The place where Jesus was crucified is the same place where the temple was put, in the same place as Abraham was with Isaac. That temple then, of course, is the place where sins were taken care of, especially once a year through the Day of Atonement, when a lamb was substituted in the place of the people, when the lamb's blood was taken so that the people's lives would not be. And what we discover in the gospel story is that this one and only son, not like Isaac, there was no substitute for him, and here's the reason why. Because he was the substitute. There was no voice that said, do not lay your hand upon the boy, because Jesus was the lamb. There was no ram in the thicket that came over and took his place, because he was the lamb who on that temple mount was slaughtered, was sacrificed to take away our sins so that we then could be reconciled back to God. Just as in this scripture, God said, I love you now. I can trust you now. You've passed the test because you did not withhold your son from me. Listen carefully. You can trust God with your life because he did not spare his son. he did not withhold his only son. You and I were the ones who deserve to be there. You and I are the ones who deserve the punishment for our sins. We are the ones who set ourselves up as gods, blaspheming the Almighty, not giving him the worship that is due to him. We deserve to be the ones who are coming under the knife of justice. And yet God, in his great love for us, did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all. Or as John 3:16 says, God so loved us that he gave his one and only son. And the son said, "Here I am, Father, I will do your will." He voluntarily laid himself down on that wooden cross. So how can you trust that Jesus, how can you trust God with everything in your life, no matter what happens? How can you trust that he actually loves you? Because he's demonstrated his love for you. He's demonstrated it not just in saying, "I love you." That would be enough if God did that. I mean, he should be trusted if he says it. He's done it, though. He's demonstrated it in the facts. He's demonstrated it in that he did not spare his only son, but gave him up for us all. Out of love, he was punished so that you and I might never have to be, so that we could be sons and daughters of our Father in heaven, trusting him with our life, though we often don't understand his ways. We can say to him, "Nevertheless, Father, not my will, but yours be done." I want to end this series on a note where we respond. So I'm going to invite the music team to come up. As they come up, I want to kind of do like we did a few weeks ago. I want to give you an opportunity, if you want to come up to the front and to kneel. And again, I think there's something powerful about physically kneeling, for that is the ultimate act of surrender, isn't it? You know, in war, if somebody surrenders, they don't walk up and stand face to face with the victor. They kneel. But we're not walking up to a general who's conquered us through violence. We're walking up to a king who has conquered us through love. So we kneel before him and we surrender to him. So maybe this morning you're here, and I wonder if there's some here today, you're not a Christian. You've controlled your whole life. You've been the God of your own life. And this morning you're hearing there is opportunity to be forgiven, to be restored back to God. Today I want to call on you at this very moment to surrender your life to God, to come before him and say, "Jesus, forgive me when I've tried to be my own God. You take control of my life." I'll sit up here in the front row. Pastor Kevin will sit over here. If you want to come speak with us as we play these two songs, we can talk to you about how you can become a Christian and how you can do that. But maybe you're a Christian here today. Let's end this series simply by surrendering, coming before him and saying, "You're God, I'm not. Forgive me when I've tried to be that." And perhaps you want to just come to the front. We're going to give a little more time. We're going to sing two songs. Maybe you're in the balcony. Come on down. Don't let that hinder you. Maybe you just want to sit where you are. That's fine as well. But let's have a time of response. At the end of this series, the very simple response is we put God in the place he deserves to be, whereas he is God. We are his creatures. Through Christ, we are loved by him, and we come and surrender ourselves to him, saying, "My life and everything about it is yours." Let's move into a time of response now.